in her sentences than there are in Champ's. Just if you're looking at it, there is a, when Champ has an aside, his is in parentheses. When she has an aside, it's a long dash. But also, you know, she doesn't have the same perspective as him, so she's not going to be cursing or thinking so erotic all the time.
And she's also much older.
Yeah, she's also
so probably
older.
Her thoughts are more rational, yeah. More linear.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, that was definitely a challenge. I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have counsel, though. You know, I mean, that's a hard, hard thing to do. Like, I paid attention, but, you know, to be inside the head of a woman is a... Even when I read the text, it's hard for me to read her because I feel like I'm not doing her the justice she deserves.
Well, I bought it.
Okay.
Place seems like an incredibly important part of the story. Talk about how the setting affects each of their lives.
Place is really important to me personally, and even what I read, I tend to gravitate to authors who not only use setting as almost a character in their work, but who seem to want to elevate their hometowns. I think, you know, go back to Faulkner and his kind of imaginary town. But the most recent guy that I can think of is the way Junot Diaz, what Junot Diaz does for New Jersey. And I thought, as far as I know, like I know like Chuck Palahniuk, and there have been a lot of Portland writers who wrote about Portland, but they've done it from a different perspective. And so I wanted to kind of elevate Portland, or not elevate, to bring light to a different kind of Portland. And I think, you know, it obviously shapes what these characters can and can't do, what they dream, what they don't dream. Place is really important.
What do you say kind of shapes their sense of identity?
Yes, definitely. Champ is hyper aware of how he needs to comport himself in these circumstances. And given another set of circumstances, which would be another place, he might be a different person. Like if he had grown up in, you know, the suburbs, he might have ended up becoming a scholar because he loves school. But because he's not able to have those kind of aspirations, or he has to temper them, then he develops into the kind of character that we see in the book.
And so I'm from Portland, and I know that you're from Portland.
Yes.
Do you think that it would sort of come through to somebody who is not as familiar with all these streets and neighborhoods and whatnot?
I do not think that they would be familiar with the streets, but I hope that they'll just kind of read over that and get to, you know, what's humane about these characters. And like, their longing doesn't have a place. You don't have to know where Burnside is to know that someone wants to escape a neighborhood that's not built for them to succeed. So yeah, I don't think that they will, but I kind of put that in for the people to, you know, for writing for that small audience who will recognize that and say, well, yeah, I used to ride down Alberta, or I know where Fremont is. That was really important to me.
Okay, so what you just said kind of transitions to the next question.
Mm-hmm.
Both of the characters are very flawed people, but ultimately the readers root for both of them. Mm-hmm. What makes them so redeeming in the end?
I would hope what makes them redeeming is the honesty in their longings, and then the honesty in their flaws. Like, there are moments where Champ will just come out and say, like, one particular kind of paragraph where he says, you know, I know that the reader is tired of hearing about me talking about conquest and women. And, you know, I don't want to talk about it either. Meaning Champ, he doesn't want to talk about it either, and he's sorry. So I think for that level of honesty, even if you don't like the characters, you have to respect that they're telling you the truth. And in the truth, there's some kind of redemption.
Yeah, I found that chapter to be really compelling.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like Champ was putting on a front, mm-hmm. for much of the book, and then he sort of lets his guard down to, right. admit that about himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that actually came from when I was talking to my editor in one of my earlier drafts. My editor was saying, she was like, wow, Mitch, you need to take a look at the way you're characterizing women. Like, every time you describe a woman, it's by a body part, or it's something negative, or something. And I didn't recognize it, so I went back and looked at it, and I said, wow, I have a problem. And, you know, really it was something I did that was unconscious, but I had to go back and consciously look at that, and then not only to look at it, but to ask myself, well, why am I doing this? And, you know, how can I, not, I don't want to say fix it, but how can I make sense of this to myself?
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I came up with was obviously taking out some of those descriptions. But the other thing was just to be honest, like, well, here's why I think he is doing this.
Sure. I wasn't actually even going to ask you about this, but it kind of brings up, Champ is very influenced by Big Kenny, right? Who's sort of his stepdad, who's a pimp. Uh-huh. And he thinks that's kind of one of the reasons why, you know, he's such a womanizer. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit?
One of the things that Big Ken was to Champ was not only a father figure, but just an affable guy. And so I think, you know, and pimps by necessity have to be charismatic. So I think that Champ was enamored of his stepfather's charisma, and that because he was charismatic, it made it easier to stomach what he was doing. And so he ended up not idolizing it, but he ended up condoning it in a way that maybe someone else who was less charismatic, he wouldn't been able to do that for him. So, and you know, even if you don't want to be a pimp, if you grew up around people who have that kind of relationship to women, I think that some of that mentality is bound to rub off on you. And so maybe it is why Champ is a lightweight womanizer, or maybe he's a full womanizer, but Big Ken played a role in that.
So kind of following up on the last question, on the flip side, both Grace and Champ are well-intentioned, but are constantly making decisions that sabotage their long-term goals.
Yes.
Why are they always shooting themselves in the foot?
I think they have a goal, but not a real strong plan. And because they have a goal and not a real strong plan, they don't really believe in the goal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like saying, yeah, you tell a little kid, remember when Barack got elected, everyone was saying like, well, a little kid, you now little black boys can be president. Well, that's both true and not true, because if you're, you know, a criminal at the age of 13 and you get five felonies by the time you're 20, you can't be president. Like, it's not going to happen for you. So, but if you had a plan that, you know, I'm going to be involved in politics when I get young, and I'm going to go to Harvard and I'll be a Rhodes Scholar, then you might have an opportunity to do that. But just saying that I want to be president is not enough for you to do it. And so I think that's the same thing that happens to them. Like, Champ wants to buy the house, but he doesn't really have a plan. Rhonda wants to get out, but she is kind of just taking it day by day. She doesn't really have a plan to do it. And so they just become dreams or longings rather than something that they can affect.
Yeah, I noticed that especially with Grace. Mm-hmm. Like, it seemed like Champ, he has sort of like more going for him.
Yeah.
And Grace had fallen into drugs. Mm-hmm. And now it's like she wants to get clean. But now it's like, what does she do now?
Right.
She's running around town going to all these different job interviews. Mm-hmm. But she doesn't have very good prospects. And
Right. She
ends up working fast food, which she isn't passionate about at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I see what you're saying, especially about her.
The same kind of thing happens for Champ, though, too, because though he's in school, like, he doesn't know what he's going to do with his degree. He doesn't know whether to go to graduate school or not. I mean, luckily he's in school, so it takes up his time, but what is his real plan other than this harebrained scheme to buy the house?
That's true. Yeah. In some ways, even though Grace is Champ's mom, he seems to take care of her and his brothers more than she takes care of him. Mm-hmm. Talk about their mother-son role reversal.
I think when you have a parent that is an addict, and you become of a certain age, you begin to recognize their faults and you try to step in where you can, maybe where you can't either, but you try to step in. And so the roles become switched because now you feel responsible to keep the family going. And I think that's the situation that Champ found himself in with Grace, was that he could see her flaws, and once he figured out a means to kind of support himself, he became, you know, virtually the breadwinner for him.
Champ has his foot in a couple of different worlds, including the academic world and the street. He seems to fit in everywhere, but also seems like kind of an outsider. Talk about that.
I think that in an environment like Champ's, that there are some expectations for young men. There's a narrative for a young man, and I'll just take myself for example. When I was 10 years old, everyone started playing basketball. And most of us were told, if you can do this well enough, it'll pay for college. And so then we started to compete. And, you know, some of us were better than others. And we, you know, at a certain point, probably high school, we started to get attention from playing basketball on a local or state level. It became our identity. And so now, instead of being called whatever your name was, they would say, oh, there go the hooper. Or there go such and such to play on such and such team. That became something that was really, really important to Champ, was that the identity.
So something I notice about Champ is, like, he's really adept in all situations.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
He's super smooth.
Now I got it. Yes.
But it's like, okay, he's at school, mm-hmm. and it seems like he feels like he doesn't fit in that well at
right.
school, like when he gives his speech
mm-hmm.
and everyone reacts really negatively.
Yeah.
But then he's also, you know, dealing drugs, but it seems like he doesn't fit in that well
right.
there either. He's always really scared, and mm-hmm. he's sort of like, why am I doing this?
Okay, that's what I was saying, is that basketball creates an identity, and if you step outside of those expectations, you are outside of the norm. And so I think his academic life was him stepping outside of that. The people, when he's like in the barbershop, they tell him don't use big words. They can't understand that side of him. And then when he's in school, those people can't understand the drug dealing or the person who's a father figure to their brother. So there's no point where there's a collective of people just like him for him to be all of who he is at one time.
Grace's story shows how difficult it is to get your life back on track after going to prison and being a drug addict.
Mm-hmm.
People act as though all you need is the desire to get clean.
Right.
But what obstacles is she really up against?
Getting clean is the main obstacle. What I think, you know, you're up against the system. I hate to blame things on the system, but it seems like, you know, once you have to fill out that question and say, yes, I have a felony, like, you really, the power in what happens to you next is taken out of your hands. So that's a really big thing. Once you get caught in the system and you have to admit that you've been in the system, I also think that welfare and things like that create a legacy of dependency and make things easy for people. So once she's been on welfare for 15 years, like, what is the real motivation to get a job? So she's up against her legacy of kind of dependence in another sense. And just like Champ, she's up against her identity. Like, she was Miss Corporate America at one point, and no one thinks of her that way anymore. And I think that kind of dogs her as well, that she doesn't matter to the world as much as she would like to.
I also noticed, like, she gets sent to live in this apartment complex,
mm-hmm.
And it's like there she runs into all these people that, you know, she used to smoke crack with,
mm-hmm.
and there's like this huge temptation to get back into
right.
it. And she initially doesn't want to live there, but there's nowhere else for her to go.
Right.
I felt like that was a big factor. And
yeah.
She's always running into that guy, Michael, who's...
Yeah, Mike is bad news. Yeah. But that's part of the system, right? Going that she's sent to that place because that's the only place for her to go. And I'm sure that the state people know what's happening in those kinds of places. So, again, that's not being able to escape the quote-unquote system.
So you think it's sort of a combination of, like, her own lack of agency,
yes.
and then the system making things so difficult for her that she can't do anything else?
Exactly. That's exactly what I think it is.
Because sometimes she talks about, like, she pulled the scam where she was collecting welfare in Oregon and Washington.
Yeah.
But she justifies that by saying that, you know, she needs all this for her boys. For her boys, and, yeah. like, that's true. But she also sounds kind of whiny and, like, she's right. not taking responsibility at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that it's hard to accept responsibility when you failed, right? Like, you don't, I mean, who wants to do that? Like, okay, it was all my fault. So I think that that's one thing. And it's just so easy to blame a figure or an entity rather than to take a look at yourself and say, what are the tangible things that I could have done differently for an outcome that I would have rathered?
Champ's relationship with Kim is also a real focal point of the story. Mm-hmm. Do you think he really wants to work it out with her?
I think he thinks he wants to work it out with her, but I don't think that he really knows what the expectations are of a strong relationship. I mean, he hasn't seen one. He saw his mother. He has Big Ken. Like, so his grandfather, if he was watching that relationship, as Rhonda describes it, is not a healthy relationship. So he hasn't seen that. And though he might aspire to, you know, a regular loving relationship, like, he doesn't have the skill set.
This is Jennifer for Between the Covers, and I'm here today with Mitchell Jackson, author of the book The Residue Years. Yeah, I thought it was interesting at the beginning how the prologue is sort of a flash forward
mm-hmm.
to what sort of ends up with Champ and Kim and their baby.
Right.
I didn't know that when I first read it.
Oh, okay.
See, because I thought that had come before everything else. Mm-hmm. And then reading the book, I realized that that's actually after.
Yeah. I did that because in the whole process of writing this book, I was hyper sensitive to the prospect of someone being able to say, we've heard this before. We've seen this before. Like, there's another story of this, you know, hard on his luck black guy in the streets, you know. So, and I didn't want them to be able to dismiss it as just that. So a challenge to myself and also to readers was, we know how these stories end, right? There's not really that many outcomes. So I'm going to tell you how it ends, and then I can find another way to compel you to get to that ending. So that was really my rationale in putting the ending in the beginning. Is like, I know how these end. Yes, you know how they end. And now we can get that out the way and get to what matters is how you get there.
Yeah, that was an interesting choice mm-hmm. because whenever Champ was doing anything illegal
mm-hmm.
Or, you know, whenever he had any encounters with the cops,
mm-hmm.
I would be mentally thinking, okay, this is it.
Yeah.
This is what he's getting caught for. But then
yeah.
he would get away with it over and over again.
Yeah.
So that definitely built the suspense
mm-hmm.
over the course of the novel.
Oh, that's good. I like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't say that I've actually ever read anything that was that similar to this before. I've seen movies,
mm-hmm.
I've seen TV shows
mm-hmm.
that kind of told this narrative, but I haven't ever read a novel. Oh, okay. Speaking of which, so this is your first novel.
Yes.
And I know you wrote Oversoul, which is the book of stories.
Right.
How does it differ to write a full-length novel from just writing a short story or other types of like creative writing you might have done?
Well, a novel just takes everything that you've learned. I mean, I guess a story does it as well, but just it's so many different, I don't want to use a cliche and say balls to juggle, but it's so many different elements in a novel that you have to manage. And, you know, there's so many more expectations. Like, you could write a novel that didn't have any plot, but it probably wouldn't work very well. And so, you know, one of the real, and this just goes along with story writing as well, but one of the important things for me to figure out was, what were my character's motivations? Not, do you want to buy some Nikes next week? But like, what is in your heart, what is it that you want to become? And then what is standing in the way of that? And so I had to do a lot of that kind of psychological excavation to do a novel, and then, you know, figuring out ways to present the material in a way that was fresh. It's a lot tougher doing a novel. I mean, that's why it took, you know, 12, 15 years to do it.
So I know that it's kind of autobiographical.
Mm-hmm.
How autobiographical is it?
I don't know what the percentage is. It started off as, you know, a pretty high percentage, and now I like to think that everything that I wrote in it is true, whether it happened to me or it didn't actually happen or to someone I know. But if I were to give it a percentage, I would say, you know, 30-40% of it is some things that happen. Nothing in the book is exactly how something happened or who it happened to, though. I was careful to not do that.
So it was very fictionalized.
Yes. The it started off much more autobiographical, and the more that I worked on it, the more I realized that I needed the leeway of fiction to shape a story that got at a deeper truth than rather than just what happened.
Also, that might be really personal.
That too.
You know, to write a truly autobiographical novel that's not actually your autobiography.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
For me, I'm always writing autobiography. You know, if it's writing that I care about, if it's not necessary. Well, even I think in journalism, like, there is a saying, I forgot who said it now, but that a writer is always writing their autobiography. But take, for example, when I write a story for, let's say, Vibe. I haven't wrote for them in a long time, but let's just say I'm writing for Vibe. And I'm doing a feature on someone else. Well, when I sit down to describe them, how I see the world is going to color how I describe them. So in essence, I'm writing my autobiography, even though I'm writing about someone else. And the same thing comes with a character. Like if I create a character that's a part of me, that I'm giving elements of myself or people that I know to that character. So in a sense, it becomes autobiography again.
So I was wondering, is there a portion of the book that you'd like to read?
Yes, there is. Let's see. This is when Champ is in the abortion clinic. He's taking his Kim to the abortion clinic. So I'll read this part. Okay. So every chapter starts with an epigraph, which is really a bit of dialogue from whoever's perspective we're in. And this is from Champ's perspective, and it says, around these parts, it ain't but three types of men. Do you want to know what kind of guy I am? Do you really want to know what kind of guy I am? I'm the type of dude who takes hellified relational risk and hopes the fallout coerces me to some decisive act. Take my girl. She's a good woman, one of the best I've been with. And we know we're not talking no short list neither. But sometimes, no lie, I wish instead of always accusing me, always threatening me, instead of doing that, I wish sometimes that she'd just leave. I mean, how many times does she have to discover a random number or an empty condom wrapper in my pocket? How many times does she have to suffer an acidic message from some scallywag? How many 9/10 true rumors of me banging some chick does she have to endure before she splits? Not threatens to bounce, but sashays right out of my life for good. Those lustrous tresses waving goodbye, so long, have a cursed life. But since it don't, as I said, seem like she's making no definitive plans to break, I revert to my backward tactic of inviting atomic consequence. Only, here's the thing. It hasn't worked. Matter of fact, the most it's done is flame already tense situations, e.g., she won't leave and I can't leave a woman who loves this hard and hurts this true. So I figured I'd go raw a few times in hopes I'd knock her up and she'd stay for good, or post-conception, she'd realize I was not the one, visit the clinic, and flee for all time. Though, all the while in the deep recesses where my purest sense exists, hoping my little spermatoza would swim right past the target, cause truth be told, I'm about as ready for fatherhood as any old young punk you see on these streets with his pants hung low and a permanent sneer. In fact, in most of the ways that matter, I might be the paragon, the one who's aborted by logic at the most inopportune times, then left to feel ambivalent about decisions that affect not only my well-being, but somebody else's baseline joy. Real talk, if making tough decisions is part of being a man, then I might wind up a geritol-popping juvenile, which is fate accompli for guys like me who screw up our lives one lousy decision at a time.
Well, thanks so much.
Yes, thank you. That was fun.
I'm Jennifer Kemp for Between the Covers, and I've been speaking with Mitchell Jackson, author of The Residue Years.
What was the main thing that kept you out from falling back in?
You don't want to be a lifetime commitment to it, and you probably had other aspirations.
It was like everybody was trying to save me because I was not the one that was supposed to be doing that.
I'm proud to know somebody who honors the language in the way that he does.
Was it worth it? Was it worth it?
I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to see you turning out in such large numbers.
KBOO Radio is proud to sponsor Keep Alive the Dream 2014, the 29th annual tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This annual event, a production of World Arts Foundation Incorporated, will be broadcast live from the Anthem Convention Center at 3300 Northeast 172nd Place in its entirety on KBOO on Monday, January 20th from 11 a.m. to 6:30 p.m. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side under Community Events.
It's hard to think this great man is dead.
Mo is Shy, the KBOO docudrama based on the Portland Christmas tree trial, airs this January 29th, 6 to 8 p.m. Here's Ken Jones as prosecutor Evan Bishop.
On November 26, 2010, the day after Thanksgiving, thousands of American families attended the Christmas tree lighting ceremony at Portland's Pioneer Square. Little did they know that this defendant had been plotting and scheming for several months to murder them all.
January 29th, 6 to 8 p.m.
Moby Dick, or The Whale, by Herman Melville.
Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse, and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail. It's a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it's a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. This is my substitute for pistol and ball. With a philosophical flourish, Cato throws himself upon his sword. I quietly take to the ship. There's nothing surprising in this. If they but knew it, almost all men in their degree, some time or other, cherish very nearly the same feelings towards the ocean with me.
Hello, you are listening to KABU Radio 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, Oregon. This is your volunteer-powered community radio station. My name is Gene Bradley, and today we have Nathaniel Philbrick coming back to visit us again to talk about his new book, Why Read Moby Dick, which is now in paperback, published by Penguin Books. Mr. Philbrick, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back.
Thank you for coming around. Now, since 2000, you've written big books about big American stories. You've written about the Mayflower. You've written about Custer's Last Stand. We talked to you about that last time. Your new book is about Bunker Hill. What brought you to Moby Dick and Herman Melville?
Well, I wrote a book in the heart of the sea about the story of a Nantucket whale ship. And by the way, I live on Nantucket. That's where I am right now. And that got rammed and sunk by a whale in November of 1820. And it's the real-life event that inspired the climax of Moby Dick. But where Moby Dick ends is just the beginning of a story of survival when it comes to the Essex disaster, in which the men took to their three whale boats, and after 3 months at sea, only five survivors were left alive. And it was with that book that I got an appreciation for the historical circumstances on which Moby Dick is based. And now that I live on Nantucket, it's the holy ground of Moby Dick, where this is the port of the Pequod, from which Ishmael and Ahab and Queequeg sail. And so I've got a real kind of personal connection to it. But I have to say, with Why Read Moby Dick, I'm making the plea that it's not. This is a book that transcends everything. Moby Dick is not just about a whaling voyage. It's about America. It's about the world. It's about the universe and how human